You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK Quad Cities NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and today we're going to look back at an event that happened 50 years ago this month, and for many of us still has a direct connection to it, the event, but also a song that came out afterwards about it. It's tragic, but I think for a lot of listeners of a certain age, it brings back memories of a time in their lives when they'll remember this event through the song. The Edmund Fitzgerald ship sank in November of 1975 in Lake Superior, taking 29 lives, a true tragedy. It was later put to music by Gordon Lightfoot, who was one of my favorite performers back then, favorite singers. This song rose to the charts. I remember you could listen to it all the time on, I remember WLS growing up and some of the FM stations. And I could still hear it. You could still hear it a lot on some of the satellite stations as well. My guest today is the author of a new book on this. His name is John Bacon. And the book is called The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. It's really a good book. I really recommend it for folks looking for something to get for the holidays for a loved one. But John, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Robin, thank you.
Really a good book and gets into so much that I certainly wasn't aware of about the book. But I guess let's start with the role of the Great Lakes shipping in our economy and national security. Let's start right off there. That kind of led to the events that the book concerns itself with.
Sure. I will confess, as you and I were discussing off the air, that 95% of what's in this book, I really did not know 4 years ago. And the embarrassing part there, Robin, is I grew up here. I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And my parents got a place up north, as we say, on the lakes. We all grew up on the Great Lakes and been in all of them, and I thought I knew it fairly well as a history major. So a lot I didn't know. One, how big the Great Lakes truly are. They're as big as all of New England plus the state of New York. How about that? So, and then how important they are, of course. What amazed me also is they're actually more dangerous than the Atlantic Ocean, which I had no sense of whatsoever. But every seasoned sailor I talked to, by that I mean not wind sailors, but freight carriers, cargo ships, and so on, they all say that that's true. And the reason is salt water smooths out the waves on the Great Lake, on the ocean, and spreads them out, as does the fact that the storms are 500 or 1,000 miles from you, of course. So by the time the waves get you on the ocean, they're kind of like smooth roller coasters. Whereas in the Great Lakes, they're sharp and pointy like a mountain range. They're twice as close together, not 10 to 16 seconds apart, but 4 to 8 seconds apart. The storms are what's called locally occurring storms, Robin. And I asked one of my sailors, what does that mean? He goes, it's right over your damn head. So pardon me, but true. These things kick up very quickly with very little notice. So for all those reasons, and several more in the book, it's considered more dangerous. So there's that. So why do it? As Willie Sutton, the old gangster, allegedly said, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. So what's on the Great Lakes region? This certainly includes Iowa, I would say, and certainly Illinois. Yeah. Well, you've got the most fertile region in the world, and this produces more grain around the world than any other place. And number two is Germany. That's how far you got to go. This place feeds the world. Lumber, of course. You've also got limestone you need to turn iron into steel. And then you've got copper. Three times more money was made out of the copper rush than made out of the gold rush. How about that? And then, of course, iron is king, as we've discussed. So during World War II, iron was so important. You get the iron from the northern reaches, and all the stuff is in northern Wisconsin, northern Minnesota, the upper peninsula of Michigan. You got to get it all down from Lake Superior down to Gary, Indiana, Chicago, Milwaukee, Detroit, Toledo, Cleveland, and so on. So how do you do it? You have to get through the Sioux Locks. So to get all that iron from the Sioux Locks, which connects Lake Superior to Lake Huron, that's a crucial connection. So during World War II, FDR stationed 7,000 troops in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, to protect that very small Sioux Lacs, to take that 21-foot drop. Why? Without that, we don't get the iron down to Willow Run, Michigan, where they're creating the B-24 bombers, one per hour every hour for 3 straight years. That's Rosie the Riveter and that bunch, of course. That made Sault Ste. Marie the single most protected point in all of North America during World War II. That's pretty incredible. But that's how important this is. And of course, after World War II, from 1945 to 1975, as I said in the book, this region, the Great Lakes, was Silicon Valley before Silicon Valley. 37 of the top 100 companies on the Forbes top 100 list all revolved around Detroit. General Motors 1, Chrysler, Ford 3, Chrysler 7, tire companies, oil companies, glass making companies out of Toledo, steel companies, and so on. It all revolved around Detroit. And here's a fun fact for you. In 1960, what Great Lakes town was more populated than Miami, Tampa, Jacksonville, Nashville, or San Jose, California? And Robin, you might recall this from the book, but I bet other folks don't. The answer is Toledo, Ohio, which is shows you the might of this area during this time. It totally dominated the economy of the world. So that's how important shipping is, because shipping is 3 times more efficient than trains and 6 times more efficient than trucks. So it's not even close. So this is where your cement in your basement comes from, the wood in your house, the steel in your car and your driveway, and the food in your table. It all comes from these ships. There's your little synopsis there, Robin.
There you go. That's really interesting. The arsenal democracy, very dependent on the Great Lakes region. This really wasn't any ordinary ship either. I mean, I really appreciate how you went into detail on the background of what led to that fateful day. The economic background, the characteristics of the Great Lakes, but also this ship. This was not any ordinary ship, was it?
No, it wasn't. And of course, it's famous for having sunk, sadly. But what I did not fully appreciate before I started my work, Robin, this ship was famous in shipping circles on the Great Lakes long before it went down. When it was launched in 1958, on June 7th, 1958, the namesake, of course, the Edmund Fitzgerald himself, he was the CEO of Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance. His whole goal was to create the greatest ship the Great Lakes had ever seen, and they did. It was such a big deal when it was launched. 15,000 people came out in Detroit, where it was launched, to see this ship get christened. And that was more than the Detroit Tigers were averaging at that time. So that's a good crowd. It was the longest ship at 729 feet, which is a 73-story skyscraper on its side. It carried the most cargo, is one of the fastest ships. It was a heavyweight champion, a workhorse, a sprinter, all in one. It set every record for cargo on the Great Lakes repeatedly. It could carry 26,000 tons of taconite. Taconite are little rusty iron pellets, is how they pelletize this stuff to make it easier to load. The equivalent of 4,200 adult elephants, enough taconite on one ship to build 7,000 cars, and it did it 50 times a year. So 50 trips, 5 day round trips down to Toledo and back to Minnesota. So this ship was all that, no question about it. Guys I talked to, I got to 6 crew members who had been on the ship before it went down on November 10th, 1975. Obviously, these guys were not on it that night because all 29 men were lost, sadly. These 6 guys all said the same thing. If you're going to be on this ship, you better get a haircut because your photo's going to be taken every time you get to Duluth or through the Sioux Lacs or Port Huron or Detroit or Toledo. You are famous if you're on this ship. Tourists actually wait for you to arrive and take your photo.
That's an indication too of what a shock this was when this happened. But let's go to that day, November 10th. Just provide our listeners with background. The ship was taking off. Where was it going? What did it have on board? Where was it headed? And just kind of the circumstances of where the background of that day and the ship, if you would.
Sure. A lot of ships carry different cargo. They'll carry taconite one trip and copper the next, or limestone or whatever. Not this ship. The Edmund Fitzgerald almost exclusively took taconite, these little rusty iron pellets. and almost exclusively ran from what's called the head of the lakes. That is Duluth. Near there is Two Harbors, Minnesota, Silver Bay, Minnesota, or Superior, Wisconsin, right next door. So on this last trip, they were leaving from Superior, Wisconsin, to go through Lake Superior, down the Sioux Lachs, drop off the load of taconite at Zug Island, Detroit, which is right on Rouge River, goes right back into the Ford Motor Company to build cars, and then dock for the year at Toledo. So that was going to be the end of the trip. And in fact, it was going to be the last trip of the season and the last trip of Ernest McSorley, the captain's career. So he and five other of his pals in the pilot house have been together from ship to ship to ship. They're very close. All promised their wives this is going to be it. And in fact, the week before was going to be the last trip. But Ernest McSorley wanted his bonus check for exceeding cargo to pay for his wife's medical care. Nellie was in 24-hour care, probably for cancer. So it makes it all the more heartbreaking. But that was the background. So they're supposed to leave on Sunday, November 9th, from Superior, Wisconsin. It's a gorgeous day. It's 70 degrees in Duluth, which it shouldn't be that time of year. And you think that's good news. That's bad news. Because as you know from the book, the longer winter takes to arrive, the nastier it's going to show up. So that's going to be bad news. And there's a storm coming in from Alberta, Canada, with cold, dry air. That'll be bad news. Another storm coming up from Oklahoma that turns around. It's called a Panhandle Hooker. How about that name? That was also going to bring hot, wet air and heavy winds, all in front of Whitefish Bay. Whitefish Bay is basically the drain of the bathtub that is Lake Superior at the far eastern end. That is safety for these ships. If you get to Whitefish Bay, you're going to be okay, as a rule. So what happens instead is that storm sets up shop right in front of Whitefish Bay, like a catcher guarding home plate. And that will be waiting for the Fitzgerald.
It was just a perfect storm. I mean, of circumstances that led to this. I thought it was interesting too, how kind of elementary a lot of the technology was with weather forecasting. I mean, we take for granted now. I could sit here and look at the radar of where anybody's at, just by, you know, bringing it up on the Weather Channel site. But it was kind of rude. I don't know if that's too strong a word back then.
Was definitely very rudimentary compared to what we have now. You have more GPS and forecasting in your phone than they had in the pilot house in 1975. But even at the time, the forecasting was complacent, and so was the communications with the captain. They could have done a better job. Both those, you know, storms could be tracked, and they only really tracked the one, the Alberta. So the captains were not well informed, and what they knew, they did not pass on to the captains in an appropriate manner. In other words, the true severity of what's going to happen was not recorded and not reported to the captain. So even with the technology they had, they could have done a much better job.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm really delighted to have John Bacon on with me today to talk about his latest book, The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. The story is tragic. The song by Gordon Lightfoot was made, and of course is a way that a lot of people like me, who were, I was in college at the time, were introduced to this tragedy. John's authored 14 books on sports, business, and history, seven of which are critically acclaimed national bestsellers, including five New York Times bestsellers. So we're just given a little background on the Edmund Fitzgerald on the Great Lakes, and then the specific nature of this trip. They took a route, if you could explain, and there's some really good maps in the book too that help you visualize all this, but they kind of took a different way, and there was another ship with the Edmund Fitzgerald on that day as well. If you could kind of chart us through the route the ships took and what then came next when they hooked down and started heading south?
Yeah, no question about that. You already mentioned the perfect storm. There's no question about that. But also, more than that actually went wrong. So when they leave Superior, Wisconsin, at about 2 o'clock on Sunday, November 9th, pretty early on, it's going to be clear that a storm is coming. The storm they believe from Alberta, of course. They do not know about the southwestern storm. So he and fellow Captain Bernie Cooper of the Arthur Anderson and Dudley Paquette of the Wilfred Sykes. And by the way, I've been on two of these three ships. Obviously, you cannot get on the Fitzgerald, but I've been on both those ships to track the same course, actually. So those ships are still running. But anyway, they all three of them decided to take what's called the Northern Route. The Northern Route means instead of going, if we think about Lake Superior as a rectangle, as a box, basically, instead of going along the southern shore, which is the fastest way to get from Superior in the south, southwest to Whitefish Bay in the southeast, they do three sides of the rectangular. They go north and then east and then south. Now, that is a very cautious move, very unlike McSorley, who's a very aggressive captain normally. Very prudent move, and this is his last trip, so why not? So, in the process, though, a few things happen. One, it takes 14 more hours to go this direction, the three corners, then the three sides, then one side. So, you've given that southwestern storm a 14-hour head start to set up shop right in front of Whitefish Bay. It'll be waiting for you, and he does not know that. Two, of course, it's pay me now or pay me later. You take that route to get the protection of the land and the islands on in the Canadian side, so you have much less wind and therefore much calmer waves when you take it north and then you take it, of course, east across. But on the way down, pay me now or pay me later, on your last leg, it's going to be the worst leg because now you've got 350 miles of Lake Superior wind coming across that lake, generating bigger and bigger and bigger waves, and they're all going to hit you sideways, in other words, broadside. And that's not how captains like this because broadside is the most dangerous. You can capsize that way, of course, and you're more vulnerable to being pinned down by a big wave. So there's your second problem. And Robin, here's your third. Your third is that he does not know this route nearly as well. I got to two guys who've been on the ship that year, and they said we didn't take the northern route once. And they probably hadn't taken the normal no, the northern route in, you know, a year, 2 years, maybe 3 years. And he takes the southern route 50 times a year, 100 times if you count round trip. He's taken that route thousands of times in his 32-year career as a captain, and very rarely, maybe on two hands, the northern route. Why does that matter? Because when he's going down south on that last leg, his long radar is out, his short radar is out, the lighthouse at Whitefish Point, where you're trying to get to for safety, that light is out. And then on top of that, the radio beacon from that lighthouse that tells you where you are, signals to you out at sea, that is also out. So you're basically sailing blind with gobs of snow, winter has now arrived, going in front of your ship as you're hitting 30 and 40-foot waves. So what happens next? He may have gone over a little patch of land called Six Fathom Shoal. This Lake Superior is 1,300 feet deep, but not there. There's a little island called Caribou Island, 1 by 3 miles. It's a nasty little swamp of bugs. The caribou left long ago, probably swam over to Canada. There's no reason to go to this place. And in front of it, Six Fathom Shoal. A fathom is 6 feet. So 6 fathoms is 36 feet, but in some places it's only 11 feet. And this ship has got 29 feet in the water at any given point on a good day, and this is not a good day. And Bernie Cooper, the captain of the Anderson, is convinced that the Edmund Fitzgerald, he saw it on the radar, go over 6 Fathom Shoal. If so, it probably took on a lot of damage, and that's why water is getting into the ship and making it list to starboard. And that means tilting permanently to the right side. Why does that matter? Because now you're getting closer to capsizing and you can't steer it nearly as well. And on top of that, you're more vulnerable to a big wave taking you out. You're like a three-legged animal in the wild, and you're in trouble.
It's there was communication from the ship up until a point where that they had you write about Captain McSorley's final words. Talk about that a little, and I just the sadness here that I felt. This is like one of these movies where you know what's going to happen, and you keep thinking. I don't know why, but you like reading this. I keep thinking something's going to happen to avert this, and I know it's not. In the end, it doesn't. But it's just such a tragedy and just a perfect alignment of things, as I said, a perfect storm that caused this. But you could go back kind of to the end there and McSorley's final words.
Sure. So after crossing probably over 6 Fathom Shoal, around 2 o'clock, he calls Bernie Cooper, the captain of the Arthur Anderson, to talk about the various problems he's got. His fence railing is down, two vent covers have been blown off by the waves, and in passing, He mentions his starboard list. That means he's again leaning to the right. And then around 5 o'clock, he calls back again. And now he mentions the list first. So we can probably assume that it's getting worse and worse, which lists will do. And then finally at 7 o'clock, they talk for the last time. Bernie Cooper is talking to Ernest McSorley, and he says, "How are you making out with your problems?" And Ernest McSorley says, and I quote, "We are holding our own." And those are the last words anybody knows from the Arthur, from the Edmund Fitzgerald. And about 10 minutes later, the ship disappears, off the radars, no communications. And that's probably when it went down in 530 feet of Lake Superior.
One of the really fascinating elements to me in my takeaways from this book, and there are many, is what happened afterwards and the fact that ships actually went back out on these rough seas to search. And you call it the sailor's code. Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, so the Arthur Andersen is chasing the Edmund Fitzgerald. It's 1 hour behind. And that hour behind is extremely lucky, because the experts I talked to run computer models on these things for Michigan Tech University and University of Michigan and so on. They said that David Schwab said that the Edmund Fitzgerald managed to find itself in the exact wrong spot at the exact wrong time. And that means you're facing 100 mile per hour winds in this one little circle. Those are hurricane force. And then waves that are 30, 40, 50, maybe even 60 feet high. And again, this thing only has 11 feet out of the water. So you don't need that. So that certainly explains part of why it went down. But after that, the Arthur Andersen gets to Whitefish Bay around 9 o'clock, passing the point over Edmund Fitzgerald. The Coast Guard's, excuse me. Hope you can get that one. Sorry about that, Robin. The Coast Guard's ships can't go out that night. So the Coast Guard asks several ships, cargo carriers. These are not rescue ships. The Arthur Andersen, the Wilfred Sykes, the William Clay Ford, to go back out with their full loads in these crazy 30-foot waves to try to find a ship that everyone knows by now is gone. They have no illusions about that. And yet they did not hesitate to go back out. And I got to one guy, Rick Barthuli, probably the last surviving member of the Arthur Andersen crew from that night, the closest we can get to an eyewitness of what happened on that trip. And he said, "We felt the ship turn around. No one asked us. We all knew what we were doing. We all knew it's a really bad idea because we can have another ship there at the bottom and with us on it. But none of us ever thought twice, because that is, as we said, is the sailor's code, because they would do it for us." And when you read the chapters about the Morrell in 1966 and the Bradley in 1958, they had both had survivors floating around in rafts in 20 and 30 foot waves, freezing cold, hanging on for 36 hours in one case. And these guys always said the same thing, that what kept us alive, what kept us going, was the thin hope that somewhere out there, a stranger who does not know who we are at all, in the Coast Guard or in another ship, would risk their own life to save ours. Because there's no way you can save my life without risking yours in those situations. And that's what kept these guys going back out. They went back out. It took about 14 hours to go back around and come back. And the turnaround is horrific in those waves. But they all did it. All they found was debris. But I still think that was very heroic and noble for them to do so.
Nobody knows what happened specifically, but to the Edmund Fitzgerald. But in just reading the final couple chapters, it seems like you make a plausible case that this six-fathom shoal may have been the culprit, where the Edmund Fitzgerald ran aground on it, and maybe it forced a leak of water into it that then caused the sinking. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I tend to side with a guy named John Tanner. He's the former superintendent of the Great Lakes Maritime Academy in Traverse City. He had two cadets of the 29 were his former students on that ship. He says, when a big ship goes down, it's rarely just one thing. It's usually a confluence of events that conspire against you. In this case, the storm of the century, the construction of the ship that was more flexible than most, mechanical failure we already talked about with the radar and so on, and a well-meaning decision that probably backfired, which is taking the northern route. So you add it all up, and my guess is they did go over Six Fathom Shoal. And the reason I think that is, A, there's some general thoughts about that, but I found for this book, a guy named Dick Race was the best investigator on the Great Lakes, the best diver. He found a jumbo jet in Lake Michigan when no one else could find it in the late 60s. And he produced a, he dived down on Six Fathom Shoal, and he found the red paint on the bottom of the Six Fathom Shoal. This is the sandstone, hard stuff. And nearby rock was all scratched up, could only be from a ship, he's convinced. He produces a report, and that report went to the company that leased the ship, Ogilvie Norden in Cleveland. But Ogilvie Norden went bankrupt in 04. Dick Reyes died in 02. The company goes bankrupt in 04. A guy I found named Peter Groh went through all the boxes for 2 years of all their ships, all their archives, and found all the boxes except for three, and all three are on the Edmund Fitzgerald, none of them signed out by anybody, and no trace of any of them. So that almost certainly is where that report is. Trust me when I tell you, Robin, I tried very hard for 3 years to find that damn report. But I found the next best thing. And that is that Dick Race, who took that secret to his grave because of the NDA agreement, he did tell four people, four experts, John Tanner, Ed Wiltse, a captain of the Great Lakes, Tom Wyatt, a captain on the Great Lakes, and a lieutenant with the Chicago Police named Earl Zuehlke, told them all the exact same thing at different times. I found the red paint. It was the Fitzgeralds. I'm convinced it hit at Six Fathom Shoal. So that is one more huge problem you can add to the Emmett Fitzgerald's overall problems.
About out of time here. I'll just add that you do a service, I think, to the folks on that ship by profiling them and their lives. And these were good jobs on the ship. You talk now about working class people in modern politics. These were working class type jobs, but they were prized, and these folks were married to the sea, so to speak. I guess just wrap up in a minute here, if you would, just kind of what the legacy is here. I mean, again, for a lot of us, it holds a special meaning kind of because of the song, but then learning more about it, it really is a part of Americana here. I think that the legacy of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
But yeah, these were blue-collar guys. Most of them, none of them, college educated. Some of them not even high school educated. Who basically were self-educated on these ships and did a very good job. This was the American dream, working, good union jobs, paid pretty well, and their kids went to state schools and whatnot. But one quick story: Eddie Bindon, number 40, age 47, first engineer on the ship. The day before they left, got a 2-carat diamond ring for his wife for the 25th anniversary. And instead of putting that in his duffel bag, he's going to see her in 3 days in the docks of Toledo, and he's going to retire with that gesture. He gave the ring to a good friend of his in Duluth, and a love note wrapped around it, and said, "Please mail this to my wife." And we have no idea why Eddie Bindon did this, but he did, and of course we know the rest. The ship goes down, and a few days later, she receives this ring and this note in the mail. She wears that ring the rest of her life, and she never remarried. So, those are the kind of stories that we found repeatedly for these guys of different sorts, naturally. But this was, these guys were right in the apex of the American century in shipping, a vital industry, and this was really the American dream at its best.
John Bacon's been my guest today on Heartland Politics. He's the author of a new book, The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Again, it's a really good book, almost like a detective book in some ways, but a lot of research, a lot of background on economics and just the lives of these people. And I recommend it. Be a great stocking stuffer if you can fit it in a stocking. But anyway, John, thank you so much for being my guest today. Really appreciate it.
Robin, thank you very much. We're number 12 on Amazon and we're a New York Times bestseller. You can find out more at johnubacon.com.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK Quad Cities NPR.